AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Secretary of State John Kerry meets today with Iran's foreign minister, part of the negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. Kerry says all those involved face a short deadline.
We have set the end of the month as the deadline. And so we will be going into this understanding that time is critical.
In Washington, the White House is pressuring the Senate not to act on a bill that would require congressional approval to lift sanctions against Iran. Here's the AP's Shirley Smith.
The White House is again telling the Senate to stay out of negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, asserting that pending legislation would have, quoting now, a profoundly negative impact on the ongoing talks. President Obama's chief of staff sent a letter to the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee saying the administration just wants to complete the negotiations before Congress weighs in, and that lawmakers would then have a chance to debate any deal during the approval process. Shirley Smith, Washington.
Aid flights making their way to Vanuatu's main airport as a Pacific Island nation works to recover from Cyclone Pam, which slammed into the islands Friday and Saturday. New Zealand Air Force Squadron Leader Lee Foster tells TVNZ his flight plan is to check a smaller airport by air before delivering supplies to Vanuatu's capital city.
We're going to descend into Tana, a quick reconnaissance flight over the runway there to have a look at how badly that small island has been hit, and then onbound to Port Vila.
Foster has to avoid the big storm during the flight since it's on a track to come close to his country's North Island. 14 people are dead, scores more have been injured in a pair of suicide bombings outside two Christian churches today in Pakistan. The Pakistani Taliban is claiming responsibility for those attacks. This is AP Radio News. A tugboat captain is dead. His three crew members survive a sinking about a mile off New York's Fire Island. Coast Guard Commander Mark Averill tells WABC-TV the crew made a desperate call yesterday afternoon.
The phone call to the vessel traffic service ended abruptly, and then we lost their transponder off our system, which is an indication that they sank at that time.
The three survivors were able to don cold water immersion suits before the tug went down. Security concerns curtail U.S. Embassy activities in Saudi Arabia. The U.S. Embassy in Riyadh and two other diplomatic missions in the country have canceled all consular services for 2 days. Officials wouldn't say more, but the move follows a warning by the embassy on Friday, citing information about a threat by militants against Western oil workers, including Americans. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Green light. Hey girl, school zone. I'm getting hungry. Car changing lanes. You want to meet me for pizza? Stop sign. Intersection clear. Yeah, street. Pizza sounds good. Ball in street? Girl in street!
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The traditional light bulb, a groundbreaking invention in 1879. It's time we switch to longer-lasting Energy Star light bulbs. They're more efficient than the old bulbs, like a text message is more efficient than a carrier pigeon. And they cut down on our energy costs. Because in our own groundbreaking age, we deserve a light bulb that saves us some cash. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Arlington Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen with Optifor. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Molly Nichols, who's a partner with a firm called Redgrave, Glenn Owen, the COO of CGH Technologies, Dr. Cheryl Brissett, the Chapman, the Executive Director of the National Center for Children and Families, and finally, David Sande, who's the sales director with a company called PocketMath. First up is Molly Nichols, the partner with Redgrave. Molly, tell us a little bit about Redgrave.
Yeah, Redgrave is a law firm. We focus on information law. So that's information governance, e-discovery, data security, data privacy. Our clients are typically large corporations, and we help them with their legal and compliance issues dealing with data.
Why is that so important these days?
Well, number one, there are many laws that are now on the books that corporations have to follow with regard to their data. Number two, there's the data security, data privacy area where companies need to protect data. And for a number of different reasons, not only the personal information that's in the data, but also trade secrets and that type of thing. Any type of breach of that data can result in huge monetary fines, plus a PR nightmare.
How long has the firm been around?
We were established in 2010.
And how big or small would you characterize yourself today?
We're a small firm, but we have offices in San Francisco, Minneapolis, D.C. and Chantilly, Virginia.
And how did you find yourself practicing this type of law? Why this for you?
It was a bit of a windy path, but I started practicing law in Texas as a litigator. And I was with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Austin, Texas, and got involved in cybercrime. We were seizing computers before the law was very well developed. And so I ended up having to deal with servers and data as evidence at that time.
And why law at all? When did you first realize I wanted to be a lawyer?
That was a bit of a windy path as well. So I was very shy when I was in high school. And it was a problem for me going into college, not being able to express myself. I had a medical event the fall of my freshman year, and it was one of those things that when I was in the hospital and came through my surgery, I thought I have to change things. Otherwise, you know, I had no direction, and I decided to work on my shyness, and I joined groups at the University of Texas is where I went to school.
How long did it take you to get over your shyness?
Years.
What was that experience like? I mean, you actually put yourself into the place where it would challenge you.
Right. So I started focusing on areas that I did have some sort of public-facing role. I love to sing. And so I started singing, and that got me a little more comfortable being in front of people and doing something.
Did you do this by yourself?
I did, but I had encouragement. So when I was at the University of Texas, I did have some professors who helped me. I started taking classes like business and public speaking, and those professors actually saw what I was trying to do, and they helped put me in positions to speak. I also joined clubs, and became a leader in different clubs at the University of Texas. And ultimately, I was chairman of the board of directors of the student union, which at the time there was no student government, so it was one of the highest student positions
on
campus.
So you were telling us earlier that you actually were a litigator for a bit.
I was. After I became a lawyer, I was a litigator, and you know, it took several years.
And you chose litigation because you were shy and you wanted to get over your shyness, or you were just a good litigator?
I think a little of both. So I did find that I had a gift of advocacy.
So tell us about your early cases, Mrs. Shy Woman.
You know, I was with the U.S. Attorney's Office, so I had drug cases, gun cases, alien smuggling, cybercrime.
So how does a shy person get up there and advocate for the right thing?
It's one of those things that you have to practice, and I was not comfortable for many years.
So how does a person do this? Are you just plain determined or what?
I think determination is one thing. I like to set goals and achieve goals. I feel that accomplishment.
So let me ask you a question. Do you ever bring or fall back into the shyness when you're in court or when you're in a business situation?
Not when I'm in the business situation itself. But after that situation, I do like to retreat, and whether that's being alone in my car, walking, going for a walk, or just being by myself, I do like to retreat and have that time.
Where are you from, Molly?
Originally Wilmington, Delaware, but I grew up in Texas.
And what were Mom and Dad doing growing up?
So we were in Richardson, Texas, just outside of Dallas. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a salesman in the textile industry.
So what'd you learn from your father?
My father has a very big personality, and he has a gift of being able to talk to people and get along. He's very well-liked, and he's an advocate in his own right.
And your mom?
My mom has more patience than anybody I know, and so she was always the person who grounded me.
Other important role models along the way that kind of shaped who you are today?
Yeah, I had several. So when I was in high school, my choral director was one of those people who assisted me. And then when I went into college, I would say my professors who helped me deal with my shyness and get in front of people to speak.
Mark?
So you took to singing younger than college, and that was to deal with shyness?
I just enjoyed it. It had nothing to do with shyness, but then when I recognized that I needed to deal with my shyness, I took that piece, and that helped me get to the next level, because I could sing in front of a crowd before I could talk in front of a crowd. And so that assisted me with saying, I can do it. I already do this. Now I just need to do something else. I need to talk rather than sing.
And then once you got past the shyness issue, did you drop the singing?
No, actually. So I sang when I was in college at University of Texas. But then when I became a lawyer, I joined a group of lawyers, and we sang legal parodies. This is in Austin, Texas, the Bar and Grill Singers. And so we have produced 3 CDs, or when I was with the group, I left Texas 10 years ago. But we would travel the country and sing. We sold CDs, and we donated, by the time I left, it was close to $500,000 to legal services for the poor in Central Texas.
So do you ever wake up or in the morning and realize, God, if I wasn't so shy, I wouldn't be this successful?
You know, I don't think that way at all, but I don't know that I think about the evolution. I know I felt like I needed to get through certain impediments of mine in order to succeed, and succeed in the way that I wanted to succeed. And that's just one of those pieces. You know, another piece was, you know, I was a litigator for a number of years before I got married, and then ultimately didn't have kids until my late 30s. And, you know, it was one of those things where I thought I could do at all, be a litigator, be a great mom, be a great wife. And at some point in time, it all didn't work. And so you regroup and you figure out, how do I succeed? what are the impediments to me succeeding? And that's when I morphed my career from being a litigator to focusing on information.
And so what advice would you give, you know, young adult, high school age individual that maybe is also faced with shyness?
So if that is an impediment to reaching your goal, then what I suggest is finding things that would help you that you're already doing that a shy person wouldn't necessarily do. Or, you know, yes, it's going to take you outside of your comfort zone. Singing was that for me. Are there other things in your life? Do you volunteer at, you know, the pet shelter, and you go and you talk to the other volunteers, and you're doing activities? It's those types of things. Focus on what you do now, but then take yourself out of the comfort zone to go the next step.
What would you say your proudest moment up till now is?
Raising two wonderful 17-year-old twins.
That's all. What's the website address, Molly?
RedgraveLLP.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Molly Nichols, who's a partner with a law firm called Redgrave. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohen, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
David Sondi.
And David, what's the name of your company?
Pocket Math.
Tell us a little bit about Pocket Math.
We're a mobile ad platform.
And what does that mean?
Basically, it means that we give you access to the ability to advertise on mobile phones, tablets, in games, apps, and on mobile websites.
So if I'm a manufacturer of a product, I could actually advertise that product on a cell phone?
Absolutely.
Is that the wave of advertising now? Is that where we're all headed?
It's definitely the industry that is picking up steam.
And when did you, and you own this company, right?
Well, I'm one of people who runs the DC office.
I see. And why did you want to do this?
The entrepreneurial spirit, the opportunity to build something.
What makes you good at it?
I've done it before.
Uh-huh. Give us an example of somebody that's advertised successfully on a mobile device.
There's quite a few. Restaurants are excellent. Point of sale retail is an excellent example of, you know, using it when your proximity is close to the retail store.
Mm-hmm.
And delivering up a valuable coupon and then driving that individual back into the store.
And why do you think the consumer likes it?
It's personal.
So it can be personalized to the very phone?
It can be. The technology is still evolving, so it's not as detailed demographically as desktop or display. But as we evolve, we'll get better at that.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now we're able to do a lot on tracking via a device ID.
Mm-hmm. And why do you like this so much, personally?
It's just a fast-moving industry.
And what's the website address?
Pocketmath.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with David Sondi, who's with a company called Pocket Math. This has been your Business Spotlight. Thank you.
And your name is?
Dana Theus.
And the name of the organization?
EmpowerCoaching.com.
And what does Empower Coaching do?
Well, we support mid-level to senior managers, mm-hmm, and leaders, mm-hmm, achieve professional success by developing themselves personally.
Why does this turn you on so much?
Well, I have found in my own experience and my own leadership journey, mm-hmm, that the better I was at being a good human being, the better, mm-hmm, leader and the better business I ran, and, mm-hmm, the more successful I was. And I want to help other people do that.
So you're able to help the folks in an organization throughout the organization achieve what they're looking for, as well as help the organization move forward.
Well, to move an organization forward, mm-hmm, you've got to master the soft skills of, mm-hmm, dealing with people effectively.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn to negotiate every relationship successfully, mm-hmm, for, mm-hmm, both parties.
Mm-hmm.
You have to communicate confidently.
Mm-hmm.
I support people and help them learn to develop those skills themselves to be strong, mm-hmm, leaders.
And you have a specialty working with women?
I do work a lot with women. Mm-hmm. They're drawn to this work, but not, mm-hmm, exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And to learn more about what you're up to, is there a website address?
InPowerCoaching.com. That's InPowerCoaching.com.
Excellent. This has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of the Arlington Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen with Optifor, and for this segment we have Glenn Owen, who's the COO of a company called CGH Technologies. What is CGH Technologies, Glenn?
CGH Technologies is a firm founded in 1989 by Cindy Troutman. It's information technology, management services, and security and cyber works, both in the United States, and the launching of our international business this week.
Mm-hmm. And when was the company founded?
1989.
How big or small today?
We're roughly 180 people.
And you're the CEO. When did you join the company?
I joined in 1998.
And you tell us an interesting story on how you got your title.
I don't like titles. I don't like boxes. I'm Glenn. And when I go to people, I say I'm Glenn. I don't have business cards. I think in a role in a company at executive leadership, you have to be able to perform all functions. So therefore, if you put all my titles on a card or anybody's, it wouldn't fit.
So. Now, how did you come to this belief?
In operations, my previous life in operations, you're always titled to something. And that means you can't leave that silo. You can't leave that paradigm. And when you have a silo or paradigm as such, it's hard for people to interact with different groups. So for me, it was, I don't want to be in a box. I don't want to be in a paradigm. Like my father, it's, you just need to be fluid.
When did you realize you didn't like being boxed or typecast or labeled?
My mom would say at birth, but I would say when I didn't like being in a box, when I was diagnosed with cancer at 18 in the hospital.
So tell us about that and how it shaped this belief you have about boxes, metaphorical boxes.
I think when you're diagnosed at a young age, it's hard enough to go through something like that. It's even harder hearing some of the folks here about not having that mentorship at the hospital with you and not knowing. They label you in the hospital. They tell you this is what you have and this is the statistic. This is, you're going to have this percentage to live or die. We're going to do our best. Good luck.
And how old were you when all this was happening?
May 23rd. 1983, I was 18 years old.
So an 18-year-old, that's kind of young to hear that kind of feedback.
It was upsetting to my parents. It was upsetting to me as well, but it was more upsetting to my mom sitting there listening that her baby has got cancer. Her father died of cancer. My father's father died of cancer, and now their son has cancer. So it's an ongoing story. You know, here it goes again. It's another bow wave. How are we going to solve this one? Mm-hmm. We're not too successful in our family with cancer. So
how did you get through that experience, and how did that shape how you are today, other than you don't like to be labeled?
It's hard. When you sit there and you have no visitors and you're laying in bed all day wondering in a terminal ward, and you see children, and I just brought this up because it makes me, when a group like this makes me think of things, when I see other children with bald head and these children are laughing and playing because we don't know any difference at 5 or 6 year old, but an 18-year-old, you do know the difference of life and death. You're inspired by these little children that don't know, number one, but how you get through it to me was just determination. My father was a strong-willed person in operations his whole life, and I think if I had learned anything from my father, it was there is no end. You're going to keep going, and that's what you have to fight for.
So how does it, you know, when you tell that story, what do you realize now that because of that, I'm this?
I'm hard-headed. I'm a lot of things. Arrogant. I can admit a lot of things I am. But the one thing that I truly am, not only in the business that I'm in, is I'm passionate. I'm passionate about life, and I'm passionate that I want more, and I want people to have more. I want people to see more. I want people to think beyond what they're doing right now, but think beyond what they could have. And I think it's hard when you're out there, because when you're out there, people don't want to tend to follow that because it's outside the box. And when you're outside the box, nobody wants to follow you. They'd rather be comfortable in a box. And in my position at CGH, what I've been able to do, and in my life, I've been outside of the box. And I think that's hard for people to follow you when you're outside the box, because it's uncharted territories. As I explain it to my customers, you're going to walk out on the plank with me. It's a long fall, but it's worth it. Are you willing to take the chance? And when you find that in your life, it's not only about the job, it's about your personal life as well. It's about what you do to give back in life. And that's what I try to do.
So do you find it challenging to get people to follow your vision?
Absolutely. Every day. It's hard because people want to see a PowerPoint presentation. They want to see, okay, what are the boxes or what is the product? What is, and I don't have a business card. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I don't have these things. When I go to lawyers, what are you doing? I tell them this is what we're going to do, and I draw. I have a whiteboard. I draw. I draw the architecture. I draw this is what we need to do. When you find people who want to join you in that journey, that venture, and that paradigm of whatever you're going to do, it's very fulfilling because at the end, I've had a very successful in my whole life, but I've been very successful of trying to find people willing to go that far.
So is that the key to this, is recognizing who will something in somebody that is able to think outside the box, and that way you surround yourself with those kind of folks?
I want people in the box who I want to surround myself with. If I surround myself with people outside the box, we're just always going to be outside the box, and there's no one going to be attached to us. Mm-hmm. The success we've had is be able to get people in the box to step out, but go back in if you don't feel comfortable. But eventually have a door that you can go in and out of. Instead of a one-way door, I want a two-way door. If you don't feel good, go back in until you feel comfortable. But understand, that door is open. You can go back out if you want.
Yeah. What were you like as a kid?
Trouble, I guess. The baby of five, type A personality. I think if my mother had her choice, she would have had a leash on me just to keep me somewhere harnessed at all time. Mowing the lawn with a lawnmower at 5 years old. A chainsaw. My father came home with a chainsaw one day, and I started it up and wanted to cut wood with it. I don't know what I was going to do, but I was that type of person.
Mark. You mentioned you took scuba diving
in
college. Tell us about that.
Scuba diving to me was after going through cancer, and I had to go through a couple schools because I was pulled out of school during treatment. So my father, I told my mom and dad that I needed three more credits and I was going to finish. And the only class available was scuba diving, which was one credit. One credit meant that you get one credit. I'm 2 credits short from a political science degree, any degree. So the other 2 credits that you had to do what they called an open dive to get certified. In Buffalo, and certification in 1989, and it was actually called Shirkston's Quarry in Toronto, where we had to go. It was 38-degree water. But with that challenge, and not only did we have to go Saturday for the 3 dives, Sunday we had to do 3 more dives, so that Saturday night you had to think about, do I really want to show up? If I don't, I got to go back to the next semester of school for 2 lousy credits. So it was, as my dad said, suck it up. You got to get out there and do 2 more the Sunday dive. So that's what happened to get my 3 final credits at Buffalo. And what it taught me, though, was when you're underwater 80 feet, it was very quiet, and you can find yourself. And at an early age, I knew at that point that that's what it was.
Joe?
Well, so you say you're type A personality. You also said you're an introvert and an idiot. So how does that all balance out? Does that create the out of the box?
It does, because when I have to do public speaking, corporate speaking, or next week when I leave to do training, I have to be out of the box. I have to speak to people as I'm a big extrovert. When I'm done, I have to go back to my hotel room and be alone and be quiet. I call myself an idiot sometimes just because being an idiot means you've always got to learn. You've always got to teach yourself new things, because if you think you're smart, you really aren't. Being an idiot means there's hope and there's challenge. And I take that as an opportunity to expand myself and growth.
What's your proudest moment, Glenn?
My proudest moment is not a happy moment. My proudest moment was 2 years ago sitting with my father taking his first chemotherapy. Yeah. And it doesn't sound proud to many, but to me it was proud because he was there for me and I was there for him.
Great.
And I held his hand.
And the website address?
CGHtechnologies.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Glenn Owen, who's the COO of CGH Technologies. For more information about our leaders, don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com. We'll be back in a moment right after this.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. Isabella, what is BusinessWise CPAs?
BusinessWise CPA supports government contractors, small businesses, and nonprofits with outsourced CFO and financial consulting services.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the Marketing Director.
And as the Marketing Director, what does that mean?
Well, I actually wear several hats. My primary role is to improve and extend the branding of BusinessWise CPA through referrals, client meetings, networking in the DC area, as well as supporting current client relationships.
And what do you like most about your job?
I like the most that I don't have to be at a desk all day. I'm out and about meeting new folks and learning experiences from other entrepreneurs.
Right. What makes your organization so special in your view?
I believe our added value is that we are not just a number report kind of type firm. We're very much integrated with our clients. They rely on us for all important decisions. We help them not only with the numbers, but on the future growth of the business.
And what is it that the clients appreciate most about the company?
That they can call us and they talk to the same person every time.
Okay, and who's the perfect client?
Perfect client is small to mid-size organization looking to save on a full-time employee and as well as get the added value of the consulting.
Great. What's the website for the company?
www.businesswisecpa.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Doug?
Offit Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work with in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying, and we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying. And since then, he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offitkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offit Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of the Arlington Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen from Optifor. And for this segment, we have Dr. Cheryl Brissett-Chapman, who's the Executive Director of the National Center for Children and Families. Tell us a little about the National Center for Children and Families.
The National Center for Children and Families, known as NCCF, was founded 100 years ago in D.C. as a Baptist orphanage, and today is a comprehensive child welfare, family welfare agency in the region, serving over 40,000 children and families in a variety of residential, school-based, and community-based services.
And how long have you been the executive director?
Actually, I've been the executive director the entire time I've been there, 23 years.
23 years. And what were you doing prior to that?
Before that, I was the associate director at the hospital, Children's National Medical Center, for Child Protection Research and Clinical Services. And before that, Child Welfare League of America, where I was a national and international consultant on child protection. And before that, with the New York State Division for Youth, Peter Edelman, deinstitutionalizing New York City region.
So you help. It's a staggering number, actually, to hear it, 40,000 children annually.
And families.
And families.
Yes.
And what types of needs or people are you meeting? What are their situations?
Well, we're serving children and adolescents who have been removed from their families due to abuse and neglect in foster care, adoption, in-home services for children who are under supervision with parents who are struggling to take care of them adequately. We're serving homeless families, particularly young homeless families who have no housing or are in government facilities, trying to find stable permanent housing in the community. We are serving domestic violence victims who are fleeing men and with their children, homeless youth. The variety of young people and families who really are not able to make it without some external support, and we empower the community to help them.
When did you realize that you actually wanted to do this kind of work? How young were you?
Well, I think that I didn't know what I was doing. I was doing it, though, before I knew. I was 8 years old, living across the street from a foster home, and the young children would come and go in the driveway because they were not allowed to come up and play in the street with the rest of us kids, so to speak. And every time the foster mother would leave, I guess I've always been a rule breaker. I was rescued by my sixth grade teacher from being a behavioral problem. But I was a rule breaker, so I'd wait for her to leave. And then I would break my daddy's rule because he worked two jobs to take care of us. And I would take the food that my mama cooked, and I would take cookies and gingerbread and all that kind of stuff over to the kids and talk to them about, why are you here? Who are you? And I would hear all their stories about their mom who was sick, their dad who was working, the things that happened to them. And they would show me where they lived in the house, which was really kind of cruddy, and show me where she lived in the house, which was beautiful and ornate. And so at 8, I became an observer of other children. And as the oldest of two oldest parents, I was already responsible for my kid brother and my sibling-like cousins. And I think that's when I emerged. I think I was born into this role.
So that's great. What would be the next step then that got you to here?
I would say probably the next step is going away to Brown University, not understanding what Brown University was because of some of my colleagues in this competitive high school that my sixth grade teacher got me in, and finding out that there was a whole larger world than even the committees that I knew about in Boston. At Brown, I organized with some of my peers the Black Student Walkout of 68. I founded the Rights and Reasons Black Arts Theater, and Brown really taught me, even though I wasn't happy there at the time, but taught me how to build, be a builder, and how to build out of this core belief that all of us have a right to have a quality life and to benefit from our society equally. Brown did that for me.
You also talk about finding your voice and then using it. Say a little bit about that.
That was a big deal. I started off as a pre-med student because I was great in math because Mr. Lentini was a great math teacher at this all-girls school, so I adored him. So I did well on my SATs in math. And I found out that I really wasn't really great for physics and chemistry and the other things that I didn't really pay attention to. And I transitioned into theater and English. So, of course, I'm taking the theater course, and of course I've got to do a monologue, and of course I'm doing an angry one. That was the time, 67, 68. And my colleagues looked at me and said, what was that? And I realized that what I felt inside wasn't being conveyed, and I realized that that was what I was exposed to. I was exposed to a lot of people that could not convey internally, externally. And so I learned about voice lending. I learned how to direct. That's how I got into directing. I didn't want to act. I want the whole enchilada. And I think to this day, I still want the whole enchilada. I want to have sit in the back at Font's house and have a standing ovation. And I typecast the staff. I picked the script. I did the stage. I like the whole enchilada, this whole transformational thing that comes from voice lending.
And now you're the executive director of people that don't really have voices that get heard very often. Is that true?
Yes, yes. And, you know, I've had a lot of great mentors in my time. They've been men, very influential men, who have kind of taken me out the box and didn't look at me as an African-American female from the Deep South, but looked at me as having, you know, Arnie Sorensen is my friend at Marriott, who looks at me as, hey, we can do this. We can teach each other. So with that influence, I think I approached this whole mission of serving others from a more business-like model that the investors of the community, we're responsible for these folks finding a different choices.
So you say that we are more than what has happened to us.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning so many people carry their traumatic experiences and none of us are safe from them. Seems to be part of life, the Harvard model. Life deserves professional consultation. It doesn't have to be deficit or pathology, just life. And I think that people carry that around and they limit their self-concept, they limit their ability to see what they could be, they limit their ability to connect more to themselves, the shame, the impoverishment of their own vitality, the truth-telling that Jewish Holocaust scholars taught me. You tell the truth and then you forgive. But if you can't tell the truth, what's forgiving? You can't get to that place. Right. So we have got to be able to tell the truth that we are valuable no matter what the life circumstances are. We didn't do it.
So I asked you earlier, of all the people and lives that you've touched, was there one story that stands out about all the others? And you told us one. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Yeah, it's about the young person who taught me, actually, who helped me understand how incompetent I was in even understanding what it means to be a young girl whose mother prostitutes her. I mean, my mother is so opposite. My values, our culture is so opposite. Couldn't connect to that, and so I was enraged by that. And so tried to help her and a couple other colleagues of mine. We kind of got her through different programs, but she was suicidal a lot and kind of challenged her on, you gotta, let's do therapy here. Let's get your thoughts straight. Stop being suicidal or else I have to keep hospitalizing. And went through all of this stuff with her, but somehow she ended up being drug involved and flunking out of college that we got her in and all of that. And I'm still looking for the technology, the technique, the therapeutic intervention. What did we do? What did I do? What could I do to fix it? So here she is at her NA meeting with her narcissistic mother who triggers me, and I'm so angry till it hit me. You aren't replacing her mother. You're supposed to be helping her live with that mother, manage that mother. She loves that mother. And ultimately, years later, she had me at the funeral, again violating rules, because I came reading Maya Angelou's Phenomenal Woman, and I began to understand what it means to be a helper. What it means to be a helper is to be with folks through their trauma and inspire them, model for them, that we all can get through to a better life.
What would you say the toughest thing you ever had to accomplish is?
I think the toughest thing, I knew you were going to do this, for me is having this Navy veteran work ethic. Why are you asking me if I love you with that college stuff? I work three jobs. Father, the patriarch. Having him develop Parkinson's, and having my gentle nurse mother who went to school with her children driven with us to pursue education, to succeed and have a good life. Having her immobilized by his illness and moving the two of them next to me in Silver Spring 5-6 years ago and then being his caregiver because he gave it himself to me. And then me sitting in that palliative care meeting and make a decision about his care and pulling the plugs. It forced me to resolve my own issues with my father, who I'm much like in some ways, and to really forgive and to ask him to forgive me and to put closure peacefully in that hospice. That's probably the hardest thing that's happened to me.
What's the website address, Dr. Chapman?
nccf-cares.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dr. Cheryl Brissett Chapman, the Executive Director of the National Center for Children and Families. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment after the spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Conan Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Conan Burnett?
CohenAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Conan Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Wes Burnett, partner at Optifor. Wes, what is Optifor?
Optifor is a securities firm that integrates legal, tax, and financial and risk in order to offer optimal results for clients.
Who's your perfect client?
Perfect client is someone who actually would like to combine services, make their life simpler, and is very family-oriented. Our firm itself is very family-oriented. We love helping families take care of their own, and that can be multi-generational.
So what would a family need when they would come to you?
Typically, what they're doing is trying to simplify their personal life by trying to have somebody else worry about their legal and their tax and financial affairs and present them with solutions rather than questions.
Solutions rather than questions. So give us an example of a good solution.
A good solution is something that results, for example, in the lowest tax bill, the greatest savings, and taking care of values important to the family, like saving for college for children or grandchildren or something along those lines.
So what do you enjoy most about your work?
My clients. Although a second place, the close would be my staff, because I recruit very specifically people who have the same values as our clients. So we truly are very involved with our clients' lives, and they are family to us.
What about your family? Are they in the business too?
No. Although there's certainly plenty of lawyers and financial advisors and so on in the business. But no, they all have their own lives, and we're very pleased, quite frankly, with that. I actually have a wife who's a teacher for 42 years, so I take a lot of my values from her.
What is the website?
Optifor.com, OPTIFOUR.com.
Thanks for listening to this Business Spotlight. Here for today's Business Spotlight is Chris Vannetti, Vice President of Contract and Project Staffing Services at Hire Strategy. Chris, what is Hire Strategy?
Hire Strategy is a D.C. Metro-based professional services and staffing firm specializing in information technology placements as well as HR and administrative, sales and marketing, and accounting and finance.
And what do clients love about working with Hire Strategy?
We take an old school approach to staffing. And what I mean by that is, you know, back in the day before social media and email, it was all about people. And we're one of the few and last firms in this marketplace, probably nationwide, that really interviews in person, takes the time to know their candidates, and 100% takes the time to know their clients, their pushes and pulls, the positives and negatives, to make the right match. So it's truly a consultative approach.
Mm-hmm. What do employees love about working for Hire Strategy?
It's definitely our culture. And the employees that work for us, I think they would all to a person say, we believe in leadership, not management. And that's one of our key mottos. And leading people is a definite thing that we like to do, and we like to do it often.
So what does that mean for a new employee? They get to be a leader?
They can get to be a leader, but they're a leader of their own practice, of their own business. We allow them to be entrepreneurial. We allow them to make their own decisions, and we're there to help them along the way, correcting them if need be. But motivation and leadership is the one way that we think that people are going to excel with us.
What do you love most about your job?
I love that I get the opportunity to be a leader and to be entrepreneurial and work with a great bunch of people and a great group of executives along with myself. So it's a great place to be.
What's the website?
The website is www.hirestrategy.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the offices of the Arlington Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen with Optifor. And for this segment, we have David Sande, who's the sales director of a company called PocketMath. What is PocketMath, David?
It's a mobile ad serving platform. So basically, we allow you to serve ads in games, apps, and on mobile websites to smartphones and tablets.
So I'm looking at my smartphone, and I can see an ad on it, is what you're telling me.
That's correct.
And is this the wave of the future?
We think so. By all signs and everyone's adoption and personal obsession with their mobile phones, I think it's the direction of the future.
How long has the company been around?
Since 2011.
And how long have you been the sales director?
Since late last year.
Why did you want this job?
I love the industry. I love advertising, marketing. I love the art in communicating a message. And so,
did you have to fight for this job or what?
A little bit. It's a great opportunity. This industry is a sort of a closed network, and I was more or less recreating myself many times over. And this was another opportunity to do so. So I went into the digital media space.
Well, recreating myself many times over. You can't even be 30 years old. So how many times have you recreated yourself?
Countless.
Well, so take us to the first time you realize I got to recreate myself.
Well, it's just through life, I think you realize that you maybe not have met all the objectives of that particular challenge or task, be it school or otherwise. And so it's a constant evolution of yourself. And so I've constantly been evolving myself and wish I have mastered everything, but the reality is that I've mastered, you know, nothing. And so it's a constant evolution of your mind and your spirit and everything.
Well, for some people, that would be a very daunting challenge to constantly find that they need to reinvent themselves. For you, it's life-giving. Why is that?
I've always found that I haven't quite fit in with situations. And so, it goes back to being young and in class. And I was diagnosed very young with ADHD. And, you know, being asked to sit still and read a book from front cover to back cover was an impossible task.
How young were you when this was first starting to go on for you?
I believe I was in fifth grade. I'm not sure the age.
So at fifth grade, you're being asked to read a book that you can't sit still because you can't sit still. What's that experience like for a fifth grader?
It's extremely frustrating, to put it mildly.
How'd you deal with it?
And for me, you know, what's so rewarding right now in my life, since I've mastered this, not to accelerate past your question, but I love learning. And so what was always so challenging and so hugely frustrating at those times was the desire to want to learn but not having the ability to do it. And you know, at times it looked like, hey, just sit still, but I couldn't.
So why not just give up?
I don't have that in me. I just don't have that give up in me.
So what's it like to hear that you're ADHD as a young kid? I mean, what kind of impact does that label have on a young man?
At the time, I'm not exactly sure I appreciated it, but it was nice to know that there was something going on and it wasn't just me. You know, everything that's been thrown my way has been sort of either a challenge, and it's been something I've either met or I've, you know, come up a little bit short. But, you know, I meet the next challenge with even more rigor. So
were you ever told that because you had ADHD, you would just not be very successful at anything?
Numerous times.
Well, what did that do to you?
You know, the if you want to motivate me, just tell me no.
But some people take that kind of a label and they believe it. You didn't. What else was going on in your life circumstances that supported you through this?
I have a great, parents, sister, my father.
You tell us about an uncle, too. Tell us about him.
My uncle was very much my hero, still is to this day. Took the less straight path and veered off a few places. He did not graduate from high school. And during that time, became a bricklayer. He basically started a family and had to become a bricklayer. And in the process, you accelerate forward, he became the vice president of Clark Construction.
So if you could roll back time and chart your own destiny, would you have it with or without ADHD?
I would keep it.
Why?
Because it's made me who I am, and, you know, those are the things that make the people who they are. I like it.
So where do you want to be in 10 years?
Great question. I have a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old. I'm not exactly sure where I'll be in 10 years, but hopefully raising them and right alongside with them.
How does that shape you as a parent, the experience that you went through as a younger man?
It's tough. I mean, my son has similar challenges, and I struggle with finding patience for him. He stretches my patience, and what I want is for him to not have to deal with some of the things that I had to deal with. And I think in today's schools and systems, they've really adapted a much better program, and there's really a lot better support. And I'm really grateful for that, and I think that myself. Yeah. And the others before me have helped put that in place.
So there's a pretty good chance there'll be an ADHD kid listening to this show when your interview airs. What do you want that kid to know?
Anything is possible. I mean, and the best part about in my personal opinion about ADHD is our ability to just adapt and, have a vision.
What would you say your proudest moment is up till now, David?
So many. I don't know if I can give you a specific one. There's just...
That's okay. How about the toughest thing you've ever accomplished up till now?
I would say that for me, looking back, one of the most challenging things was graduating from college. And, just being able to get through that process and realizing that it needed a lot of dedication and hard work.
If I was interviewing your uncle, what would he say about you?
These words are echoed in my head constantly. He'll be fine. He'll do it. That's always his sentiment.
Uh-huh. You think he'd be surprised at your success?
I don't think so.
If he was here right now, what would you want to say to him?
Oh, boy. That's a curveball. I just love you, and, I just admire you. I mean, there aren't enough words. I spoke at his funeral. There probably aren't enough words for me to really convey truly how much of an impact he had on my life.
What's the website address, David?
Pocketmath.com.
One more time?
Pocketmath.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with David Sunday, who's the sales director of a company called Pocket Math. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Molly Nichols, the partner with Redgrave, Glenn Owen, the COO of a company called CGH Technologies, Dr. Cheryl Brissett Chapman, the executive director of the National Center for Children and Families, and finally David Sunday, who's the sales director with a company called Pocket Math. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohen, for helping me with the interviews. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. And if you'd like to hear this interview, these series of interviews again, you can find them on businesstalkradio.net. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This paid commercial.